So since you're here, let's all get started. So this is the last lecture about amplitudes and S-matrix bootstrap. And I want to start out by a quick recap of all the hard work we did yesterday to get to a certain point. So I won't recap everything, but the key parts of the analysis that we're going to for the bootstrap. So what we started out doing was to talk about N equals 4 surveying Mills theory. And we wanted to write a general ansatz for the low energy effective action of N equals 4 surveying Mills with all the higher derivative operators that are compatible with the full supersymmetry and what is also known for those who are specialists already, the full R symmetry, which is SU4. So at low energy, I argued, though I didn't show you all the details, but it's true nonetheless, that the 4-point amplitude with two pairs of conjugate scalars from the spectrum of N equals 4 surveying Mills takes the following form. There's the pole term, which is the exchange of a gluon between a z and a z bar and another z and z bar on the other side. That won't play any role for us both going. But then all the higher derivative operators, they are encoded in these terms with a one-to-one correspondent between operators and Lagrangians, their coefficients, and the coefficients a, k, q. And as you can see from this, this starts at order s squared, which is because in the vector sector, f to the 4 was the lowest dimension operator that you could possibly write down that was compatible with the supersymmetry. And another constraint Susie gave us, what we refer to as the crossing constraint, namely that whatever is going on inside this sum has to be symmetric under exchange of S and U. And that requires that the coefficient AK, k minus Q must be the same as AK, Q. Okay, and then again, this correspondence means that A0, 0, the leading order coefficient, would be the coefficient of A trace F to the 4. The next coefficient, of which there's only one by the crossing constraint, is one where you dress up f to the 4 with two derivatives. There's only one way of doing that compatible with supersymmetry, and that's this one, and so on, so forth. You just basically dress f to the 4 with an even number of derivatives.
So can I interrupt for a second, because now that most people are here, I don't know if you've taken minutes. I think you've sent out an email. So the 2:30 lecture will be online, because unfortunately, Darren Grant got sick and can't give the lecture. So he
would
be
replaced
somehow.
Sorry about that. But what
can
we do in this time, right? Okay, sorry, carry on.
That's okay.
Yeah. Is the lecture streamed here? Yes. So you guys will come back here. It will be streamed. So just come back to the room at 2:30. And it's just that don't be surprised if it's someone on the screen. Okay? Sorry about that, guys. Okay?
So, all right, good. So this was the low energy description, so that was the EFT part. But we also learned something about amplitudes in general. And that general discussion told us that this amplitude, when not expanded at low energy, should have a form where there are some simple massive poles and branch cuts that is associated to some high energy spectrum of which we don't a priori know anything. The only thing we assume about that spectrum is that it is such that it has a mass gap, so there are no of the unknown states that come all the way down that are basically effectively massless. They all have some higher order mass. And that the amplitude will obey some bound, that it doesn't grow too fast when you take the S variable, the Mandelstam variable, to infinity. And that is basically that it cannot grow faster than S squared. That's a fairly mild assumption at this point, but a technical one. And what this did was that it allowed us to do a contour deformation, where we picked first one contour that circled S equal to 0, and we argued how that, from the low energy part of the amplitude, allowed us to pick out exactly the kq coefficient for each one of the k's and q's. And then we could deform the contour, so it wrapped around each of the poles and the branch cut. And the branch from infinity, it didn't matter because of the Frassard mountain bound. And then we argued that we could manipulate all these different residues and the discontinuity into one big thing that we compactly wrote as a sum over the angular momentum of the particles with mass m that could be exchanged either in a loop or in a simple pole. And then the integral over all possible masses, because we don't know what they are, of some kind of spectral function, rho, that had both contributions in terms of delta functions that took care of the simple poles, as well as some more continuous part, which was the branch cut. And the key part of that is that those two contributions were both positive and added up, so that this thing that sits here was strictly non-negative. And then there were also coefficients that came here. This comes from what is known as the partial wave expansion. And that basically means that since we're in four dimensions, we can express everything in terms of the Legendre expansion in Legendre polynomials. And when we write out what the polynomials are, they're finite in this variable delta here, and the coefficient of the delta to the q is some number, which happens to be such that it is always non-negative. Okay, so these things are never negative. And that means whatever we go here and get from this, the first observation that we already made yesterday is the statement that all the AKQs must be non-negative. Okay, so that was already clarifying one of the things we had observed in other examples. Not that this necessarily applies to those cases, but it was sort of that observation that when the EFTs came from some sensible UV physics, there were certain coefficients that always tended to be positive, even though from effective field-free point of view, these AKQs could be anything. But we see now that they cannot be negative. Okay, now we are done with the worst of the hard work. We'll rewrite this in a slightly simpler form, and then we will be able to sort of see more, we'll be able to directly see more implication of what this type of integral does for us. So the first thing that we can notice is that if I have some AKQ, some set of AKQs that has this kind of expression, and if I then rescale them with some positive parameters, I rescale them for all k and q with the same parameter, where lambda here is some positive number, then it's just a matter of absorbing that lambda into what this function is, this row. And then this will be just as good representation as before. And what this means is that in some sense, if I think about the space of all AKQs, as being some vector in a huge higher dimensional space of all the coefficients in the EFT, then this is only projectively defined in that I can always rescale that whole vector and I can still get something that is a solution. So that means that we only expect to fix ratios. So we only expect to place bounds on ratios of these things, of AKQs. And you can pick different ones, but often we will pick the ratios of AKQ to the leading order coefficient, namely the coefficient of F to the 4, which is A00. So we will often see that the bounds will be placed on these ratios, simply because we can always rescale, so you cannot place an upper bound, say, directly on A00 off of this. Now, another thing, does that make sense? It's good? Yes?
So it's like there's a kind of n-spherical symmetry. Because we could just normalize all of those vectors.
No. So in a sense, there's only one vector. There's this vector that you can think about being a vector in some going up to some, they say, AK max. Which we'll talk about later, what that goes up to. So you could think about this high-dimensional space. And again, from low-energy perspective, where you don't think about any UV physics, like they have to come. Well, bye. Okay, it went into the higher levels of the atmosphere. I guess it got a little lofty. A priori, this could point anywhere in space. But now we learn that all these coefficients have to be positive. So that is already one constraint, that it can only lie in one, so to speak, quadrant of this higher dimensional space. But there will be much more stronger constraints on this. And the statement was just that because I can rescale them all, I could also rescale them all by A00, and I cannot hope to place stronger bounds on things than on ratios. Okay. But I can't rotate these into each other. Already at this point, the way these were defined, as you can tell, from this expansion up here, the AKQs are dimension-full. And it's nice to place bounds on stuff that isn't dimension-full. And so we will use the rescaling also to make the AKQs dimensionless. And so we'll rescale and express the AKQs in terms of M gap. So I'll rescale them with M gap to the K plus 2. And that will be my new AK, Q, which is now going to be dimensionless. Okay, so we'll do a couple of steps, and that will redefine this integral. And I'll simply tell you what it is. I'll define a new variable, new integration variable. That replaces the m squared over here with x. And the x will be dimensionless and be m gap squared divided by m squared. And then I'll redefine the row into a PL of x, which is going to be x times rho L of m gap squared divided by x. And because we're integrating over positive m squared, the x will, of course, also actually already be greater than 1. Sorry, less than 1. Less than 1. This will be a quantity that lies between 0 and 1. And that also means that this quantity here will always be non-negative because rho was non-negative and x is positive. OK. So when you do this, you get a different representation of the AKQ coefficient. And that is just changing variables in an integral. So you get the sum over L integral from 0 to 1. This is because of m gap. That is where you hit 1, is when m is equal to m gap. So that was the lower bound before. But we're taking care of our signs carefully. And this now gives us an expression that looks like that. And this is the expression that we're going to work with in the following. Okay, so this is just a rewriting of what we did before by a change of variable. But it'll be very helpful that we're integrating not from a gap that we don't know to infinity, but just over the range from 0 to 1. And this innocently looking little prefactor, which is just a constant in the integral, times the rescaling from up here and the redefinition of what m is, that is, gives that x factor, which turns out x to the k here, which turns out to be very important in the discussion. OK. Let's see. OK, feel free to ask questions along the way. So what we'll do now is to extract information from this. It seems maybe a little peculiar that this should contain information, but we'll soon see how it works. OK, so then we get to the second observation, the first one being that all the AKQs have to be non-negative. So the next thing we notice is that if I took Q to be 0, then I look over here. And the 0 coefficient, the way a Legendre polynomial always starts out is with a coefficient that is 1. So VL, 0 is 1 for all possible values of L. And so if you move this term, then you see we have an integral over something positive, sums the power of x to the k. But x lies between 0 and 1. So the bigger k is, the smaller this integrand is. And it's integrated over a positive region, 0 to 1 always, and then summed. So this must imply that because x lies between 1 and 0 in the integration range, the ak 0 must always be smaller than the ak prime 0, whenever k is greater than or equal to k prime. Okay, because the higher power of k makes the integrand smaller, and therefore you get a smaller coefficient. Make sense? So I'm integrating a positive function, but one is always smaller at every x than the other one, so the integral over that and the sum over all those things must always be smaller. So you get this inequality. In fact, that is true for all q. In fact, we get that ak for any q is less than ak prime at the same q whenever k is greater than or equal to k prime. So we got that. So this has an interesting consequence. When we look at our leading coefficient, a 0, 0, that was the coefficient of f to the 4. Yeah, there's a question? Oh, no? Okay. Then what this tells us is that this must be greater than or equal to a 1, 0. Right? And this, again, must be greater than or equal to a 2, 0, which must be greater than or equal to a 3, 0, which must be greater than or equal to a 4, 0, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But by crossing, a 1, 0 is the same as a 1, 1. And a 1, 1 must be greater than or equal to a 2, 1, which must be greater than or equal to a 3, 1, which must be greater than or equal to a 4, 1. Dot, 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 dot. That was nice. Okay. So what about this guy? This guy must be equal to a 2, 2 by crossing. This guy must be greater than or equal to a 3, 2, which must be greater than or equal to a 4, 2, which must be greater than or equal to dot, dot, dot. And this guy must be equal to a 3, 3. Who must be greater than a 4, 3? Who must be greater than and dot, 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 dot. And so now you see that the combined constraint of these inequalities with crossing tells us that there's one coefficient that is the biggest one of all of them, and that is this guy. The leading coefficient as a number, dimensionless number, must be bigger than all the other ones. So a 0, 0 is the biggest of all. And that, in turn, has some consequences.
One question.
Yes, go ahead.
Are those relations of decreasing numbers related to a perturbation?
It's a low energy expansion. So we are expanding in low energy, which is what you see here. I'm expanding in small s and small u in the low energy expansion, which is what in EFT, Lagrangian language, would be the derivative expansion. So this is relating those coefficients that at low energy are there in terms of what the high energy is here. So this is a good point to make, that this is low energy description. The information that you have access to at low energy. And what this encodes is clearly high energy. That is the physics that takes place above some scale of which I don't know. We can also call this the UV scale, but I call it gap because I want it to be a gap up to where I don't have anything. And so all of this on this hand side is high energy physics, or UV physics, of which I a priori don't know anything. If I knew it, I could calculate this. If I knew everything about the theory, I could calculate this in principle. A priori, I don't know what this rho is. And so I can't calculate it. I just know the low energy information. But because it comes from some sensible high energy physics, it has to have this form. And this form of the integral, which we now rewrote in this language here, has these implications that it imposes inequalities on the low energy coefficients. Whereas from the low energy point of view, you should have been allowed to have anything. You should have positive, negative numbers. Naturalness says that they should be sort of the scale of m gap in dimensionful units or order 1 in dimensionless. But now we see that there are certain rules that the UV physics imposes on them, which is that there is this one that has to be the biggest, and then there's a hierarchy among the other ones.
So, sorry.
Yeah.
So, is this similar to integrating out high energy degrees of freedom?
Yeah, so this low energy prescription is what we would say is resulting from integrating out high energy physics. And all that unknown high-energy physics is what gets encoded in these coefficients. That's the language that we normally we wave our hands and say. But this formula here is what makes it precise in which way that high-energy physics is encoded into these low-energy coefficients from, by, so to speak, integrating out massive modes. Very good. OK, so one of the things I mentioned was that the geometry of these higher-order coefficients is projective. And that implies that these ratios, now because A0, 0 is the biggest, they must lie between 0 and 1. So we see as a consequence now that all AKQs normalized by A0, 0 must be numbers that are not only positive, but also less than 1. And so that means that the range of things that we have to look at before they could be any numbers, positive or negative, now not only do they have to be positive, but when normalized in terms of the leading order coefficient, they all have to be less than or equal to 1. And that is something that is obeyed, for example, by the string. Okay, so first consequence was this hierarchy, and the consequence of these ratios that we're going to place further bounds on are bounded in this way. Okay, so far so good. Now we're going to extract even more information from this integral. So from deep down in your mathematical roots, you may remember a thing called the Cushy-Schwarz inequality. And that relates to inner products or norms. And we could think of this quantity here as some kind of inner product of norm, where the measure is given in terms of p and even these coefficients, and this is also part of the function that you're taking a norm of. Now, if you use that inequality for that integral, I'll just tell you the result. That implies, among many, many other inequalities, that the coefficient a10 squared must be less than or equal to the coefficient a200 times a00. So you can think of this as the square of an integral, and Cauchy-Schwarz says something about that being less than some other norm times some other norm, you know, this type of things that happens. So this is what it is. Okay, then, so what? Well, we could also rephrase this as a10 divided by a00 squared has to be less than a20 divided by a00. And at the same time, we also know that this quantity is bounded from both above and below by 1. And so now I can draw a plot that shows a10 over a00. So this is one projection of what this looks like. So here we go, a20. We already know that these numbers have to be lying between 0 and 1. Okay, so they have to lie in here. And we know from the inequality right over here that a10 has to be bigger than a20. So if I draw the diagonal right there, then this says that this coefficient has to be smaller than that coefficient. That means I have to lie below the boundary. So this bound is a20 being less than a10, of course, all divided through by this positive quantity a00. So I have to lie in this triangle below. But now this inequality tells me more, which is that there's also a lower bound on a20, not just an upper one, which is basically a parabola. And yeah, I can write it, this arrow down there. That gives me that the only allowed region here is this sliver that lies between the diagonal and basically x squared, so to speak. So this is very interesting, right? Because before everything was allowed. Then we learned that positive was allowed. Then we learned that between 0 and 1 for these ratios was allowed. But now we have ruled out, by very simple means, a large part of that region and only allowing this little sliver. So in one sense, you might not be impressed, because if you know nothing about A10, you also know nothing about this coefficient, because if this can be anywhere, A20 over A00 can be anywhere. But if somehow you thought about something similar happening in Fino, and you could go out and measure and say, suppose that I could measure a quantity and it was right there, it was right here for one of these coefficients, then I know that there's a very narrow region that is allowed for the other one. And that's powerful. So there's one potential application of this outside this regime. Okay, so that is one example of a bound. It is an example of a bound which in some sense is exact, that when I change and include higher and higher derivatives, I get, in general, stronger and stronger bounds. But this bound doesn't change. It's not replaced by anything. This is the exact result. One thing you might wonder about is that yesterday I told you that the string is in this range too. And so we can ask, where does the string sit? And the string sits somewhere, say here. And that is a little bit of a story. That is assuming this point is where alpha prime string times m gap squared is 1. But I could also pick this to be any number satisfying the gap bound. And then I find some curve that goes down like this. So the string lies anywhere along this, depending on what the ratio is of alpha prime to m gap squared. Is anybody bothered about the string sitting there? Not the least. Okay, the string is here. Smack there. So how many people are familiar with the conformal bootstrap? Ising model, 3D Ising models, bootstrap, islands? No one. Okay, they should have had a lecture series on that. Those are three other lectures we can give another time. Okay, so one of the things that often happens in exclusion plot is that the interesting theories tend to lie on the boundary. So in particular for this conformal bootstrap, they had some exclusion plot, it had a cusp, and that cusp was exactly where the 3D Ising model sit. The 3D Ising model is a critical point, a conformal field theory that describes the critical point of water. And it also describes the Curie transformation, the Curie transition in a ferromagnet. Same type of physics, but same mathematics describes very different physics. So you might be bothered that we look at this and the string is not at the boundary. And I also said that these bounds were exact. So there's nothing about including higher and higher derivative terms that in this projection here seems to narrow me in on the plot. But maybe we should not be worried, because this is, if we think about this space, it's a higher dimensional space of Wilson coefficients. And what I did here is just I projected it into a plane in order to illustrate what that space looks like. And if I project some higher dimensional space, for example, a sphere, into a plane, then if I look at the North Pole, if I look and I project down in this direction into the board, then I get a disk. And this particular North Pole lies right on the boundary of the disk. But if I have rotated a little bit, then I could just look and project into a different plane, and that's now where the North Pole is. And now when I project it down directly into the board, I find that the North Pole is here. It doesn't look like it's at the boundary. So this is just happens to be, does that make sense? You can just rotate the ball and look at it, and it'll project into the interior as opposed to the edge. So you could ask, is there some rotation of this higher dimensional bounded space of coefficients in which the string would project onto the boundary? That's a very hard question to solve. This is a high dimensional thing, and how do I rotate it around in order to get just right for projecting into some two-dimensional thing I can put in a paper. And moreover, it may not even be that way, but that will come to that in a little bit. All right, so this is one example of how we get bounded regions. And there's a bigger story around this, which is that all the bounds that come out of this give a geometric, in the sense that one can argue that not only are they positive and giving some bounds, these bounds will always result in something that is a convex geometry. So you never get projections that are star-shaped or anything like that, but it will always be convex, which is great to illustrate by a hockey stick, that they can only lie within a region that is bounded by a hockey stick like this. It has to lie below, so that every 2 points on this boundary that I connect has to lie within the allowed region. It could not be like this, because then if the region was down below, these points would connect outside the region. So we have to be hockey stick convex. And because it looks like a geometry, it was named the EFT-hedron by Akani Hamed and Huang and Huang, who wrote the first paper where that word was used. But until they got there, a lot of other people used similar techniques to derive these things. OK, so the EFT-hedron is a word play of EFT, effective field theory, and hedron, as in polyhedron. And one thing you see from this is that a polyhedron always have sharp edges, right? Like straight edges, straight faces. You guys all have straight faces, even when I tell jokes. OK, so they all have straight faces, but clearly you see here there are also curved boundaries in the EFT-hedron. And that actually makes it a little complicated to study. So it's not an polyhedron, but it's an EFT-hedron. All right, so I want to tell you one example that is different from this one. Here, the bounds don't move in this projection when I include higher and higher derivative terms. But in general, they do. And so let's see examples of that. We'll keep our integral. So far, what we have done, we haven't used crossing all that much. We used it over here. But for this bound, for example, we didn't really use any crossing constraints. This came straight out of looking at the integral and seeing which integrand was bigger than the other one. But there is another thing that is true, which is not only do I have this expression, but I also have to impose crossing constraints. So I can think about this integral defining some geometry for my coefficients. And then when we look at particular planes, we're just projecting that geometry in. But really, I don't want the whole geometry. I want the geometry of that thing intersecting with the crossing constraints, which were the ones that, where did they go? They got deleted. We can reinstate them, maybe with the power of the hockey stick. There should be a better trick for this. This is the test of the speakers. Can they use the hockey stick? The Canada test. All right, so there was the crossing constraint that we had to impose by supersymmetry. Now, when I'm interested, for example, in low-order coefficients with A10, A21, A20, and so on, it may seem irrelevant to think about what happens at, say, k equals 8 or 10. But it matters because that defines a subset of planes that I'm projecting into. And so if I visualize it, I'm saying that I have some higher dimensional EFT hedron geometry. Say that that looks like this. And then I'm projecting it into some plane so that I can make a plot that I can actually show. When I project it, I would say that in that plane, this gives me the allowed region by just projecting down all of this into this plane. Okay, but I'm not interested in the full thing. I have to have the one with the crossing. And so there's some crossing geometry that comes in and intersects this bigger space. This big white space is the one that's defined by just the integral expressions. And then the crossing constraint is this blue line. And so now you see the actual thing that I want to project is this thing. And that is the actual crossing allowed space rather than the white one. And one thing you notice is that the allowed space is not the intersection of the projection of the crossing and the projection of the eftahedron, but the projection of the actual intersection in the higher dimensional space. So that makes it more complicated to analyze. And because the crossing constraint will change the plane, the higher powers of k I include, there are some projections that will get stronger and stronger bounds depending on how exactly this line would intersect that higher dimensional space. So this means that in general, bounds depend on the max value of k included in the analysis. And in terms of that low energy expansion, maximum value of k included means how high the order and derivative expansion I go to in the EFT. And so in general, we define some k max for the analysis. Sometimes you would also cut off that angular or the spin sum at some L max just for practical purposes, because when you put it on a computer, you can't really take L to infinity. But you'll take it high as L equal 100 or L max equal 100 or something like that. Okay, so you have to look at K max. So what kind of constraints can you get out? So I'm now going to plot a different plane for you, which is the plane of A21, A00, and A20, A2, or A00. Okay, so this is a different projection than this particular one, where nothing depended on Kmax. By the way, notice that Kmax translates into S squared times order S, U to the Kmax power. So Kmax translates into order P to the 2 Kmax plus 4 as the highest momentum power, which translates into the Lagrangian as terms, scalar terms, with 2 k max plus 4 derivatives on them. Okay? So even going to k max equals 2 means that I'm dealing with 8 derivative terms, which is perhaps already high. Okay. So what do I get? Well, again, these numbers have to lie between 0 and 1. So I can sketch out my region like this. And for guiding the eye, I'll include the diagonal also here. Okay, so I start out with the simplest, which is Kmax 2. So I don't include any constraints in the crossing relations from higher orders, just the ones that are required for this simple plot. And I get a bound that says that the allowed region for k max equal 2 is everything that lies below this red curve. This red curve is straight here and a little bit curved up above, and it has a cusp. And you say, oh, a cusp! A cusp is so exciting. Maybe it will stay if I go to higher values in Kmax, and maybe that's where string theory lives, but it's not, unfortunately. What happens when you then go to the next K is that you get a curve that's a little bit straight, and then a little bit curved, and there's something that looks like a cusp here, and this is Kmax equal 3. So now I've gone to 10 derivative order in the effective energy expansion. Now, I'm just going to go to one higher, because maybe this cusp is exciting, but it's not. And so I get a curve. It looks like this. And this one is K max equal 4. At this point, what you're doing with 12th derivative order in the expansion, Mathematica starts becoming a little bit unhappy when you try to plot this. And so you need to employ better techniques. And one technique that we use is linearizing the problem and using codes that people who do economic optimization use in linear optimization. And then we can go to way higher orders. Let me just give you a sense of one curve we can get. We get one here. Oops, it doesn't go below the diagonal. And that would be K max 8. And so now you get the sense that what you might expect is that the allowed region, when you allow to go to infinitely many derivatives, might be exactly that triangular region that we have here. That's very hard to prove, even as we approach K max equal 20 or 25, which is, of course, very, very high in derivative order. You cannot exactly conclude this, but we can always see how these bounds tend to move in. And so that is a little unquestionable whether there's a sliver allowed there or not. But it is one example of how, when you include higher and higher constraints from the crossing, your geometry will shrink, the allowed region. Yeah?
What's the implication if there's a cusp?
So in this cusp didn't have any implication because they went away when we included higher derivative terms. But the implication of a cusp would be the analogy to other examples of bounding regions where interesting theories tended to lie on the boundary and lie on the cusp. In this case here, the string, the open string, the Venetiano amplitude lies somewhere here. And if I vary a prime, alpha prime compared to m gap squared, then I get some straight line in this particular projection. Not again a projection where it didn't lie on the boundary. Okay. Okay. So question so far, yes?
Yes, sir. How do we get constraints like this?
Yeah.
Those are Cauchy Schwarz or some other?
So a lot of these include all sorts of constraints. So I should say that the Cauchy-Schwarz generalizes to a different type of constraints that are called Hankel constraints, or Hankel inequalities, Hankel constraints, or Hankel bounds. And they basically all come out of writing a matrix of all these coefficients. Of this form. So you write matrices of this form. Sorry, this should have been 0 and 0. And then any minor of this has to be positive. And so this is taking the determinant of this 2x2 matrix and requiring that is positive, give you exactly this constraint here. And then you can do bigger and bigger matrices and get more and more inequalities. Then in addition to those, there are a whole slew of other constraints. These ones are not really sensitive to the momentum, the spin in the sum, but there are other constraints that are. And you put all those together, they all generate a huge set of inequalities, and you ask, say, Mathematica, tell me where the boundary of all these inequalities are, what is the optimal bound? And when you have few, 10, Mathematica does great. When you start having 400, Mathematica craps out. And you need better techniques to get to even things like KMAX. So there are many other constraints than just the Hankels that you have to impose. Yeah?
After rotation, when we try move to the convex geometry,
yeah,
as you said, it's not going to be a star shape. So one Poincaré lemma does not hold anymore. So it may be relevant, but does that change any of the rules of the game?
So I don't think I understand the question. But that this doesn't change the shape because with Kmax, was that what you asked?
Yeah. What I'm trying to say, yeah. Before we have a star-shaped domain where Poincaré lemma holds, which is it says that all closed forms are one forms are at the same time exact and vice versa. But after that rotation, that lemma does not hold, so this time you have a different domain. Does that change anything for your theory while defining?
I'm not sure what you're asking about when you say that before it was star-shaped. I couldn't have a star shape ever. It was always convex.
It was always convex.
Yeah.
Okay. Then
yeah.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's always convex. And then it's just when you look in different projections, you will see different behavior. There's a whole set of projections into to planes like this one where it won't change when I increase Kmax. And then in general projections, such as this one, you get stronger and stronger bounds. One thing I should emphasize here is that we know exact solutions that lie at the corners of this triangle that solve all the constraints, and so they can never be ruled out. And so by convexity, anything that lies within that triangle can never be ruled out. And so to narrow in on something like the string, I would need to look at a different projection. This is a little bit, again, like asking that question, if I want to narrow in on the North Pole by having it on the boundary in some way, then I need to find the right projection to look at. Okay. So let's try to narrow in more on the string. And now I'll first review. I will also remove, but I will first review some analysis that was done in the past, and then I will show you how we can improve that analysis. All right. So let's see here. Okay, so this is five. Let me see, what was four? That was this story here. And we had three and four, and so this must be five. Okay, so narrowing in on the open string. And by that, I really mean the Vinichano amplitude. Yesterday, I gave you some of the values for the coefficients AKQ for the open string, for the lowest ones. But perhaps I should also give you what the actual amplitude is. So the actual amplitude in this type of string, external states, which are the same massless state as we've talked about all the time, you can write as minus alpha prime s squared gamma function of minus alpha prime s gamma of minus alpha prime u divided by gamma of 1 minus alpha prime s plus u. And it's when you expand this that these even and odd zeta values show up, and that low energy expansion had zeta values, which I should also perhaps give you the definition of. So the zeta value of s is the sum n equals 1 to infinity of 1 over n to the s. And that gives a well-known result. For example, if I sum over 1 over n squared, that is pi squared over 6, which was one of the values we saw yesterday. Okay. So we want to narrow in and on this, yeah, good.
Gamma prime?
This was not gamma prime, but I wrote that. I don't know why. I had alpha prime in mind, but it shouldn't be. Yeah, thank you. No derivatives of that guy. Okay, so let me review that earlier by Yuten Huang and Liu and Rodina and Wang in 2008, so 2008-02293. They showed that if you took EFT hedron bounds, effectively supersymmetric EFT hedron bounds, but that doesn't completely matter for the details, but if you put this in together with monodromy relations, and I'll tell you what those are, string monodromy relations, then it narrowed in on string theory. In the sense that numerically, they got within A10, which in the string value is theta 3. They got to this within a few percent. They got to a free zero, which is theta 3 as the string value, a free zero, theta 5, within a few percent. Let's say that, a few percent. Let's say it's a little less than a few percent. So let's call that within 0.6 or so percent. So that was pretty good, pretty well determined. And for the next one, they got a 4.1, which is a little bit more complicated, within that that string value, which I didn't write down. You get in within of this with about within 50%, okay? And to do this, they effectively went to k max 4 plus some constraints. So they took some subset of constraints from higher k-max, a little unclear to exactly which ones, so, but it's exactly k-max 4 or so, with some higher constraints from k-max 6, 7, and perhaps even a little bit 4, but not all of them. All right, so that was interesting, because it seems to say that I have this higher dimensional geometry, which is already intersected by the crossing plane. And it appears to say that if I now intersect this with what are these monotomy constraints, which I'll tell you about in a second, then that intersects at a point and allows me to determine some of these coefficients. Okay, so what are monotomies? Boop, boop, boop. How many people have heard of string monotomies? Okay, I think I should review them. That seems reasonable and good. So there are some linear relations that string amplitudes have to obey. And in particular, we're interested in the linear relation that strings, that the four-point string amplitude has to obey. Ah, yeah, no hockey stick. That was almost safe. That's not on the video.
That's why gravity research is important.
Did you feel the gravitational wave that came from that? It's a giant gravitational quadrupole moment generated. All right. So what are string amplitudes? So when you calculate a string amplitude, I saw yesterday that you pick a disk, and then for a four-point amplitude, you put in the insertions of vertex operators. Doesn't matter what they look like. The point is, in general, you're supposed to integrate over all the locations they can put them in, just like you would in position space Feynman rules. But you have some symmetry that allows you to fix some of the positions, and so you fix one to be at 0, one to be at 1, and one you send off to infinity. That's used as symmetry. And then you have to integrate over only one. And if I do it like this, then the amplitude that you get from this involves an integral that goes between 0 and 1, because the amplitude knows about the ordering. So this goes between 0 and 1 of an integrand that schematically looks like c to the minus alpha prime s, 1 minus c to the minus alpha prime u, and sometimes there are other coefficients that appear there. And this is basically what you integrate such that up to an overall factor, you end up with this gamma function expression. Now, this would give an amplitude that I could call amplitude with ordering 1, 2, 3, and 4, if this is my state 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's that ordering. But if I had an amplitude which was ordering 1, 3, 2, 4, all I would have to do is change that the guy I'm integrating over would lie between 3 and 4 instead. Just like 2 here lies between 3 and 4, instead of between 1 and 3. And so that would involve an integral that now goes from 1 to infinity over the same thing as above. So all that means is that these two amplitudes, as well as the last one where I put my last operator up here, must be related by some contour deformation. And that contour deformation wraps around places where this potentially could be singular, and it picks up what is known as monodromies. Long story short, this results in a linear relation, which is an example of a string monodromy, which says that the amplitude with ordering 2, 1, 3, 4, plus e to the I pi alpha prime s a 1, 2, 3, 4, plus I, oh, plus e to the minus I alpha prime, oops, there's a pi, pi alpha prime t a 1, 3, 2, 4. All of this has to add up to be 0. So that gives that linear relation among the amplitudes. And when you plug in the Venetiano amplitude and expand it out, this all turns out to be a true statement that this holds. However, you could also imagine that you took our low energy expansion of the amplitude and imposed this condition on it. Yeah, go ahead.
What's alpha prime?
Alpha prime is related to the string tension. So alpha prime is the string, in some sense, the scale of the how much tension there is in the string. So this you can think of as encoding string tension for the string. So that is the one dimensionful parameter that you have for the string, other than things from compactifications and so on. Those compactification details won't matter here because this is all true, and this is only true for tree-level string. String monodromy, this should be tree. It's not true for loop level amplitudes in string theory. Okay. So to connect the string to low energy physics, you expand in small kinematic variables times alpha prime, that's dimensionless. Alpha prime has dimension of 1 over mass squared. So these quantities are dimensionless. And that's why when we expand this quantity here in small alpha prime over s, it generates a form of an amplitude like the expansion up here, but with particular choices of the AKQs, which are these theta type numbers. Yeah?
So I have a sort of a conceptual question.
Good.
About this. Right, so we sort of using, so first of all, we're sort of using our low dimensional understanding of what symmetry is.
Yes.
To constrain these higher dimensional operators.
Yeah.
Which, I guess I don't know how well motivated that is. But also, I think on a
Which part, sorry?
So like the Suzy.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're assuming that holds all the way up.
We're assuming that holds all the way up.
And then also, I guess, so we're imposing Suzy and we're imposing this monodromy.
Yeah.
Which are both motivated by the completion of string degree.
Very good point, yes.
And then going
down
and then going back up.
Yes, very, very, very good. Yeah.
The symmetries of string theory and then we recover the string theory.
So you might not be shocked by that. That is a very good point. This assumption of n equals 4 super Young Mills is not as strong and not necessarily stringily motivated. That is a low energy assumption that we can are well motivated to put in. But you're absolutely right to say, oh, you took this very stringy thing and you imposed it and you got string. Oh wow. And so that's not recorded either. But you know that is a completely legitimate thing. You took something that is intrinsically stringy and you put it in and you got string figure out. So what? Nonetheless, it points in the direction of something interesting, as I'll show you. But you should not necessarily be surprised, of course, that I put something stringy in. One motivation for us to start with was exactly that. Let's relax the condition of monodromy and impose only supersymmetry and see how close you can get to the string. And let's try to understand, using these monodromy constraints, where the string is in that geometry, and then try to find out if there are weaker assumptions that do not come from string theory that you can impose to get closer to the string. Something that doesn't intrinsically come from string theory. So very, very keen observation that you can absolutely right that this happens. There's another thing I want to mention, which is intrinsically monodromies are stringy. But very recently, we showed how they appear in low energy physics in a completely different context that has nothing to do with this. And so I will give you a reference to that. And that is 22.12.13.998, which is a paper with two of my students, where we show that from only field theory assumptions, you can see in some certain scalar by adjoint theories, the string monomery actually arise in some sense out of nowhere. That makes the assumption of Yutin and friends a little bit more reasonable and not a little bit less stringy, that something like that can actually arise from low energy. So that is string monodromy arising in EFTs. So very good. Yeah. Other things related to that or anything else? Okay. So what you do is that you take... Wait, I already erased something. You take this ansatz, and following what Yutin and Franz did, you impose it. But one thing that you notice in this relation is that there's no odd zeta. This monodromy only knows about even zeta. So monodromy only knows about pi. And it does not know about zeta 3 and zeta 5 or anything about that, like that. Not zeta 3, not zeta 5, not zeta any kind of odd. And at least conjecturally, the odd zetas are not in any algebraic way related to the even zetas or to each other for that matter. And so there is no way imposing monodromy could possibly fix these values. But it can fix things like A00, which was pi squared over 6, and it does. So monodromy will fix A00 to be zeta of 2. It will fix A20 to be zeta 4, which is pi to the 4 over 90. It will also fix A21 to be 1/4 zeta 4. All these things are stuff with pi. But it cannot possibly fix the A10, which is zeta 3. It cannot fix the A30, which is zeta 5. But it does fix a linear combination of A31 minus A30 to be minus zeta 2 times A10, etc., etc., etc. So all the things that are left unfixed are for sure things that have zeta of odd numbers in it, but not the rest of it. Okay, so let me show you briefly what we get when we're able to go to higher levels. There should be more erasers, but I guess I get to turn around myself more times to find it every time. It's good for my step count.
There's as many erasers as a regular class, but there's a lower density of erasers.
That might be the case. All right, so let me show you a plot of what you can get. So here we have A10. Here is A30. The string values here are zeta 3 and zeta 5. And that lies in the range, and I'm going to show you a very close up. That is an initial range here between some small values. And between here, I have 1.16, and here I have 1.21, and zeta 3 is 1.20206, ... and zeta 5 is 1.03693, ... Okay, so that lies in that range. And if we look at these bounds that we get, then we get a region that looks somewhat like that, when you let Mathematica play up to Kmax 4. That doesn't seem particularly cool. But then you go to Kmax 5. I should have a more colorful chalk. Let's see, we got blue. I guess I'll change colors around. So now Kmax 5 gets you this region. Sorry, I should make sure that the string is included. Like this. Zeta 3 will now be here. Okay, so the string is there. So this is Kmax equals 5. Then you do Kmax equals 6. You get this. And if you then continue to Kmax equal 8 using these linearization techniques and methods from economics, then it might look like you get a tiny region around there. But this is wildly exaggerated, that little red thing. And you should really think of a dot that lies very tightly around the string. So you can face and I slow up the Kmax equals 8, sorry, equals 6. It would be some region like this. And that would be Kmax equals 8. And we can go higher, and we can do the similar thing also for the next two coefficients, and similarly really, really strongly narrow in. And for the coefficients AKQ that were unfixed by monotomy, these ones will be fixed within the string value up to Kmax equals 8 within, in general, between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 7 using these techniques. So these are results that will come out in the coming months that you can then see together with my students who are Aiden Herdeske and Justin Berman. So that would come out. But there's still something you should complain about. And that is exactly your point. So fine, you put in the stringy relation and you get the string out. Now we got much clearer picture of how much that narrows in on the string. So that confirms what Yutin did, but to much higher and much more higher precision. But we're still very curious about what does this mean? In what sense does that mean that the string lies on the boundary? Does it mean somehow that if this is my higher dimensional geometry of the EFT-hedron, that somehow these monotomy relations come in and intersect at some special point, whether that's a curve point or a cusp, and that the string is here. So this is monotomy, and this would be the open string. Or does it mean instead that if I imagine this is the EFT-hedron, and monotomy comes in and intersects here, and somehow this has a shape that has some bulk to it, and that this bulks narrow down and selects out the string. And so to examine that, we try to change the monotomy relations around. You can think about that if I took this situation here, and I moved the monotomy plane around by changing what are the pi's, in some sense, in these coefficients, to just different numbers, that plane would move around. And in some cases, you'd find no solutions because you moved it off. And in other cases, you should find many solutions because you intersect in here. Or if you do this and the whole geometry flattens, then you would be in this situation here when you vary around and still find solutions and flattening. And what we find evidence for is this situation and not that situation, which means that this thing that we envision as some very big bulky geometry is actually collapsing down the higher and higher derivatives you put in. The impact of that is important because, as I mentioned earlier, if you can mention a few lower dimensional operators, say in the standard model, you may not a priori know a lot about the other ones, except if this geometry that allows the space of geometry is very flat. Then other things get fixed instead of just being bounded. And that could be important in other contexts if the same thing happens in other versions of these bounds. Okay, So at the end, I'm happy to take questions, of course, about this. But otherwise, I wanted to give you a brief overview of some other things these type of bounds have been used for. Okay. And hockey stick to the rescue, or maybe this board. So I mentioned a couple of references along the way. There was the original EFT Hedron paper that applied this to some scalar theories, a couple of other things. There was Yutin's paper here with monotremes. But there have been many other cases of exploring this, some of them by people in the room, like up in the back. Okay, so let's see what else we have. So one would be for scalar field theories, like the ones we studied very early on in the first lecture when we just talked about scalars, full permutation theories, and so on. So there's a paper by Simon Caron-Witt and Van Dong. And they place bounds on theories which have full crossing symmetry in the sense of full permutation symmetry, just like the ones that we practiced writing down amplitudes for at 6 point yesterday. And then at the same time, there was Gonzalez and Deram and Posgay and Tolley. And there were also other ones around that time. There's one by Rostelli et al. I forgot the number of that one. That's also not recorded. That will be clipped out. Sorry. There's the relations of these type of bounds to causality bounds, which in one of the early papers was by Akani Hamad, so by Nima, and many other authors. That is back in the HIP-TH labeling days, so that has a shorter number. And that showed that leading order coefficient, like the one of d5 to the 4, had to be positive, both by causality type arguments and also by these type of sum rule arguments, which is what these dispersion relations are. But same kind of argument. And then more recently, there have been several other papers in that direction, but let me mention one by Deram, the author in the room, and Andrew Tolley. So if you have questions about this, you know where to go. Okay, so there's that relation, and that has continued to be explored. There is relations to pion physics at large n in rank of the gauge coupling by Rostelli and Albert. It's a very nice analysis also. And then there are also emerging Fino papers on this. Examples by your lecturer earlier, Nick Rod, together with Grant Ramon. There are some different numbers we can write down here. And what they looked at were dimension 6 operators. And then you should also ask your Beyond the Standard Modern lecturer, T1, about his work in this direction when he gives his lectures. And that bridged me directly over to the rest of your summer school. that you can ask the future lecturers about their work and past lecturers about their work in this direction. That, of course, lets go of some of the assumptions of supersymmetry, which I included here because it means I can extract all the AKQ coefficients, which is not possible in general in all theories. But it also gives a nice application to really try to narrow in and understanding what the geometry does. And that might be a more general feature that we're observing there. So with that, I'll end and just be very happy to take questions now and over lunch and talk more with all of you. So thank you. So questions? Yeah.
So what do you do when there is no mass gap?
So when there is no mass gap, so for example, for your questions yesterday, when you do include massless loops, then you have to be much more careful what you do. So so we look at this plot now. This is the S complex S plane. We had our poles. But now what we before had as these massive branch cuts, you will have branch cuts that from the massless loops extend all the way down to zero. So I can't isolate my little contour here that I used to extract the coefficients. That's one aspect. The other aspect is that my assumption that the low energy amplitude is just polynomial in the Mandelstam variables no longer hold because the couplings run with logarithmic scales, right? So now there's logarithmic dependence in that too. And so one solution that has been proposed in the EF tetrahedron paper by Nima and Yuchen Huang and the other Huang is that you basically jump off here by some amount mu, you move away your pole, and then you do your little contour here, and you extract coefficients from the more general ansatz of the low energy amplitude that includes the logarithm, and then you can do your whole thing again, the contour deformations, but the coefficients you place bound on are a little bit different than the ones you had before. But you get the same type of positivity bounds, but for slightly different combinations because you did this move. And that mu here becomes the renormalization scale of the couplings. So they explored this. There have been, a couple of other papers that looked at loop effects also. But that is the proposal for how to do it. This is a little weird because the mu scale goes off the imaginary axis where you'd maybe rather have it go in this direction. That could be possibly a small fix. But I think that deserves lots more exploration than what has been done so far. So they just scratch the surface of that just to see what you can do to get any kind of positivity constraints, but a lot more should be done on that. Other questions? Or maybe early lunch. Oh, yeah, good.
Have you proved that the higher derivative terms do not increase the coefficient boundaries?
Oh, they couldn't. It's sort of a statement that if I pick some k max equals 2, then that means that I'm only looking at some subset of bounds, which is some inequalities among all the AKQs up to including k max 2. So this would include bounds on the AKQs for all AKQs with k less than or equal to k max equals 2. So when I go to k max equals 3, I have all the same inequalities, including more, and then more. That also involves the earlier coefficients. So it's basically like saying if this is the allowed region for k max equals 2, I'm going to have the same inequalities that gave me this region in addition to more. So it can only shrink when I go up. At best be the same, but otherwise only shrink. I just get more and more inequalities so that can bound the region further. All right, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Are there any, again, this is all very stringy, and I guess strings are sort of the most developed UV complete thing.
Yeah.
Are there any examples of doing a similar procedure and where we impose a different set of symmetries and you convert to some other UV thing?
So good. So in the bottom of this, there's nothing stringy. For our particular application, we wanted to go in and narrow and see where the string was. And looking at the n equals 4 supersymmetric case was just one where I knew that there was something to find. that it should narrow in on, but it might not narrow in on anything. And the fact that without any other things like monotomy, we get a much larger space of things that are possible, including stuff that we know really shouldn't be there in a sensible theory, but we don't have other sort of theoretical means of ruling out, then it tells you that there are some other things that need to be put in to narrow the space down further. But the intrinsic part of what I told you about, the whole set of dispersion relations, these representations of the coefficient, that is all field theory. And it's only when I decide to look for the string that I put some string information in for the monotomies.
Oh, yes, yeah. I get this. So we put in this, essentially what this says is that this four-point string amplitude is fully determined by Susie and monotomy.
Yeah. But I would like to replace the monotomy with something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So that is that. I don't know if anything else is like, I don't know if quantum gravity has like amplitudes which are determined to, you know, after some symmetries, if you can do the same exercise with some other theory.
So I don't know what that would look like. I think one thing that could be more promising is that there have been some observation of some low spin dominance, that it's the low spin that tends to dominate the amplitude. So you could start exploring what happens if I say, and that has been done, for example, in this paper. They looked at what happens if they say, look, what if I don't have any spin zero exchanged at all? No spin zero states. Then you get some smaller region because that gives you a different set of constraints. Or you can say, what are the ones where there is no higher than spin 2? What is the, I mean, these are all massive spins, right? And you can sort of play around with the internal part of the spectrum and try to understand what lies in the different regions of these plots. So these plots allow large regions, but then they narrow in on the strings because we had that particular assumption. But in general, these triangle plots that I mentioned, the ones where the allowed space narrows in on this triangle, where I said, well, I know what these theories are. This one down here is where I just add trace f to the 4 and nothing higher than this. This one here is something that is nice. It exchanges to spin 0 and spin 2, but nothing higher than spin 2. And then, of course, the supersymmetric completion of that. But this one up here, I'll write it in small letters. This one is bad. I know what it is. But I also know that if I look at the poles of, you know, these residues, I know that it involve arbitrarily high spin, but for only given one mass. And we don't have a theorem that says that's not allowed, but we also don't have examples where it makes sense to have no sort of high spin suppression. So what you might want to try to put in is some kind of high spin suppression and see where that takes you. And that will cut out some of that badness up here. But there's no systematic way at this stage to do it other than what you put in by hand. So it's some kind of Reggie behavior you could try to put in, something that correlates the mass you have with the max spin you could have or something like that. That would cut out some further region. So things like that makes sense at low energy, but doesn't necessarily come from string theory, would be better to put in than monotomy. So that would be one area that I think would be very interesting to explore more. Cool. I think it's lunchtime. Thank you guys. Thanks for all the questions.